Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Christopher Jones Cruz, Marcia James, and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will bring us a Making of a Nation story on former United States President Harry Truman. But first, here is Christopher Jones Cruz.
The United States Air Force has a shortage of mechanics to provide support for its fighter airplanes. VOA recently reported that the Air Force has 725 fighter pilots less than the 3,500 it is permitted to have. It is training about 135 more fighter pilots this year than in 2014. But it will be a long time before they are ready for action. Pilots must train for years, at a cost of millions of dollars, before they have enough experience to fly fighter jets. The fighter pilot shortage is happening at a time when private airline companies are adding pilots. Private airlines pay more, and their pilots spend less time away from home. Two Air Force generals told VOA that the military is still able to meet the demands for fighter jet support. But they added that unless more pilots choose a career in the Air Force, the service will soon be unable to meet the demands of top commanders. They warn that this could possibly affect both U.S. troops and civilians. But even if the Air Force can train and keep jet fighter pilots, it must have enough mechanics to maintain the jets. And right now, it has a shortage of more than 3,000 maintainers. Mechanics at Joint Base Langley-Eustis in the state of Virginia have much work to do. They help keep F-22 Raptor jets flying. They also work on the T-38 Talon, a jet that is about 50 years old and must often be repaired. This Air Force fighter pilot says the mechanics work hard.
Maybe once a day to once every other day, or we'll bring back a jet that has some kind of issue that needs to get fixed by our maintenance before it can get launched back up. So even at night when we're not flying, they're working on the planes and making sure that they're ready to go for the next day.
This senior airman is one of the mechanics.
We all understand that the whole more with less is happening, but I mean, regardless, jets have to fly. So we're going to make it happen. But, yeah, there's definitely pain in that process.
Air Force Lieutenant General John Cooper works on ways to train and keep pilots and mechanics.
And we were living, you know, on the edge with our maintainers for a long time, but we were able to accomplish the mission.
General Cooper says budget cuts have made his job much harder. But he says the Air Force has begun enlisting and training new fighter jet mechanics. And he says if the budget does not get smaller, the shortage will end in 2021. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Thank you. report about a new public opinion survey shows that a 10-year-long period of Africans demanding democracy has recently ended. And such demands have been declining since then in the 16 countries the survey has regularly examined. The report is called Do Africans Still Want Democracy? It was written by Afrobarometer, an African nonpartisan research network. Researchers spoke with people in 36 African nations about their political beliefs. Robert Mattis wrote the report. He is a political studies professor and the director of the Democracy in Africa Research Group at the University of Cape Town. He is also a visiting scholar at Princeton University. He says he wanted to know if Africans want to live in a democracy or if they prefer military rule, one-party rule, or a strong man who does not have to worry about elections and legislators. The survey found overall support for democracy was 46%.
And that is a significant downturn from our last surveys, which we did in 2013-2014, in which support for democracy in Africa or demand for democracy had reached a high point of 51%.
Mattis says the survey found that the more educated people are, the more likely they are to support democracy.
They use news media at high rates. They engage with the political process. And they often have a more procedural view of democracy. They were learned about in school as elections, about legislatures, about representation, about rights and liberties.
Mattis says people support a democracy only if it helps them economically and politically. And he says support for democracy depends upon elections being free and fair.
Where elections are seen by people as completely above board and with a high level of public integrity, demand has maintained or even increased. But where large percentages of the people have doubts about the integrity of the election, demand for democracy has dropped precipitously.
Professor Mattis says a country's political system can be harmed if a political party refuses to accept the results of an election. The survey found the demand for democracy is higher in urban areas and among those with a high school or university education. Middle-class business people and professionals and those who work in offices also had a higher level of support for democracy.
That is the group we think have been rising in Africa over the last 5 to 10 years with the sustained growth that many countries had. People with a job are much more likely to support democracy than people who are partially employed or unemployed.
The report notes that Africa is far more democratic than it used to be. It says more than half of all Africans today live in functioning multi-party electoral democracies that are demonstrably freer than were the military or one-party regimes that previously dominated the continent. I'm Marcia James.
One day, supercharged plants may help feed people around the world. Supercharged plants are ones that grow faster than normal plant life. Scientists can speed up the growth by modifying or changing the structure of plants' genes. The modifications make them react quickly to changes in light. This all has to do with photosynthesis, the process in which plants turn sunlight, carbon dioxide, and water into food. Steve Long is a plant biologist with the University of Illinois.
Arguably, photosynthesis is the most important process on our planet. It is the driving force behind all of life.
Plants grow fastest in the sun. That is when they make the most food for themselves. But their rate of growth can slow when things like clouds or trees block sunlight. When the sun returns, it can take many minutes for growth to speed up again. This can be a problem because it means some of our most important crop plants are not as productive as they could be. Researchers say demand for food is expected to increase up to 70% by the middle of the century. They also note rising temperatures on Earth's surface. That is why they are looking for ways to improve photosynthesis and make plants more productive. Steve Long wanted to find a way to help plants get back up to speed quickly after a period of darkness. So he and his team added genes that shortened the recovery time. It also increased the speed at which the plants grew. His modified plants grew up to 20% more than untreated ones.
This finding, where we've just made one modification that has boosted crop yield, is really a boost to the whole area, because everyone else working on photosynthesis can now see if we can improve photosynthetic efficiency in crops, we will get more yield.
In Long's study, his group used a form of genetic engineering called transgenics. It means taking genes from one plant, then putting them into another. There is a scientific debate about whether transgenics is a good idea or not. The findings were published in the journal Science. Why is it important for plants to be efficient at making their food? Some of our most important crop plants are ones that are not very efficient at photosynthesis. Matthew Reynolds knows this. He is with the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, known as CIMMET. Reynolds was not involved in the research. He spoke to VOA on Skype.
Population is growing so fast, climate change is affecting negatively predictions of productivity. And so we kind of forced to push our crops to the limit.
His group studies how plants reproduce naturally. But he says that Long's work of increasing plant growth is a very big deal. He says the experimental use of transgenics is a start.
A transgenic event can prove a proof of concept, so we can start looking for natural variation as well.
Reynolds says the increased rates of production noted by Long's team are impressive. He has some hope about the process, but he also has questions.
What is the downside? Why have the plants not done that before? And we always ask those questions when we see something that looks a bit too good to be true.
Long's group worked with tobacco plants because they are easy to study. Next, they plan to perform experiments with rice, soybeans, and cassava, three important food crops. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation provided money for the study. The organization says any new technology approved from this research will be made freely available to farmers in Africa and South Asia. I'm Anne Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week, we continue the story of America's 33rd president, Harry Truman. Truman was sometimes called an accidental president. He only became president because he was vice president when Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945. In the election of 1948, Truman ran for a full term. As we told you last week, many experts predicted he would lose. But voters chose him over the Republican Party candidate, Thomas E. Dewey, the governor of New York. Americans also elected a Congress with a majority from Truman's Democratic Party. The president might have expected a Congress led by his own party to support his policies, but that did not always happen. Time after time, Democrats from southern states joined in voting with conservative Republicans. Together, these lawmakers defeated some of Truman's most important proposals. One of the defeated bills was a proposal for health care insurance for every American. One of the major issues during Truman's second term was fear of communism. After World War II, Americans watched as one Eastern European nation after another became an ally of the Soviet Union. Soviet leader Joseph Stalin wanted to see communism spread around the world. And Americans watched as China became communist in 1949, as forces led by Mao Zedong defeated the Chinese nationalists after a civil war that had lasted more than 10 years. During this tense period, there were charges that communists held important jobs in the United States government. These fears, real or imagined, became known as the Red Scare.
Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
A Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy, led the search for communists in America. In speeches and congressional hearings, he accused hundreds of people of being communists or communist supporters. His targets included the State Department, the Army, and the entertainment industry. Senator McCarthy often had little evidence to support his accusations. Many of his charges would not have been accepted in a court of law. But the rules governing congressional hearings were different, so he was able to make his accusations freely. Many people lost their jobs after they were denounced as communists. Some had to use false names to get work. A few went to jail briefly for refusing to cooperate with McCarthy. The senator continued his anti-communist investigations for several years. By the early 1950s, however, more people began to question his methods. Critics said he violated democratic traditions. In 1954, the Senate finally voted to condemn his actions. McCarthy died 3 years later. There were problems caused by the fear of communists at home. But President Truman also had to deal with the threat of communism in other countries. He agreed to send American aid to Greece and Turkey. He also supported continuing the Marshall Plan. That was the huge economic aid program that helped rebuild Western Europe after World War II. Many historians say the Marshall Plan prevented Western Europe from becoming communist. The defense of Western Europe against Soviet communism led Truman to support the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO began in 1949 with the United States, Britain, Canada, France, and eight other nations. The treaty that created NATO stated that a military attack on any member would be considered an attack on all of them. Truman named General Dwight Eisenhower to command the new organization. General Eisenhower had been supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe in World War II. In his swearing-in speech in 1949, Truman urged the United States to lend money to other countries to aid their development. He also wanted to share American science and technology. In 1951, the president asked Congress to establish a new foreign aid program. The aid would go to countries threatened by communist forces in Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, East Asia, South Asia, and Latin America. Truman believed the United States would be stronger if its allies were stronger. President Truman believed that many of the world's problems could be settled by means other than military force. But he supported and used military power throughout his presidency. On June 25, 1950, forces from North Korea invaded South Korea. 2 days later, the United Nations Security Council approved a resolution urging UN members to help South Korea resist the invasion. At first, President Truman agreed to send American planes and ships. Later, he agreed to send American ground forces. The president knew his decision could start World War III if the Soviet Union entered the war on the side of communist North Korea. Yet he felt the United States had to act. Later, he said it was the most difficult decision he made as president. Truman named Army General Douglas MacArthur to command all United Nations forces in South Korea. Most of the fighting in the Korean War took place along the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. This line formed the border between North and South Korea. Many victories on the battlefield were only temporary. One side would capture a hill, then the other side would recapture it. In September of 1950, MacArthur led the UN land and sea attack at Incheon, pushing the North Koreans back across the border. There was hope that the war could end by Christmas, December 25th. In late November, however, troops from China joined the North Koreans. Thousands of Chinese soldiers helped push the UN troops south. General MacArthur wanted to attack Chinese bases in Manchuria. President Truman said no. He did not want the fighting to spread beyond the Korean Peninsula. Again, he feared that such a decision could start another world war. MacArthur strongly believed he could end the war quickly by extending it to the Chinese mainland. He publicly denounced Truman's policy, saying, "There is no substitute for victory." Truman felt that the general left him no choice. In April of 1951, he dismissed MacArthur.
"It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual."
In the United States, military leaders are expected to obey their commander-in-chief, the president. While some Americans approved of the general's dismissal, many others supported MacArthur. Millions greeted him when he returned to the United States. There were huge parades in his honor in San Francisco and New York. In fact, few leaders in the 20th century could boast the support MacArthur had. Almost 7 million people attended the ticker tape parade given to him by New York City. And that almost doubled the size of the one given to another returning World War II hero, General Dwight Eisenhower. MacArthur gave his farewell speech to a joint session of Congress on April 19, 1951.
"I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plain at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye."
On the Korean Peninsula, the war continued. Ceasefire talks began in July of 1951. But the conflict would last for another 2 years until a truce was declared. The Korean War Armistice Agreement was signed on July 27, 1953. ...1952 was a presidential election year in the United States. Harry Truman was losing popularity because of the continuing war in Korea and economic problems at home. At the same time, Dwight Eisenhower, a military hero from World War II, was thinking of running for president as the Republican candidate. Harry Truman had made many difficult decisions as president. In March of 1952, he made one more. He announced that he would not be a candidate for re-election. The 1952 presidential election will be our story next week.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.